This is a special edition of Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, the presidency of the United States. Tonight's guest, Hubert H. Humphrey, Vice President of the United States and Democratic candidate for the presidency of the United States. Night Call is your program. Share your opinions and ideas with the rest of the country. Speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call in New York City from anywhere in North America. Here are Night Call's special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-3357. And from the New York area at 866-5010. And now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. This special edition of Night Call is presented tonight because this was the only evening between now and Election Day that Vice President Humphrey had any room for us in his schedule. Mr. Nixon, who has consistently declined a Night Call invitation, was to have been represented by Mr. Earl Kennedy, head of Black Americans for Nixon Agnew, on October 21st. Mr. Kennedy's appearance was canceled the day of the show by Mr. Nixon's office. Mr. Nixon's office then promised and confirmed the appearance of Senator Edward Brooke for October 28th. That's tomorrow or Monday night. That appearance was also canceled just this past Friday. George Wallace has also declined our invitation, but will be represented this coming Tuesday night by his campaign coordinator, Mr. Tom Turnipseed. Vice President Hubert H. Humphrey is standing by in Washington, D.C. to answer your questions. Good evening, Mr. Vice President.
Well, good evening. I'm very happy to talk to you and happy to be on your show here on this Night Call radio program. It sounds like it'll be very interesting.
Thank you so very much, sir. We have only two questions for you, sir, before we turn you over to our Night Call audience. And they're on the two major issues of the campaign, Vietnam and law and order. Earlier tonight, Mr. Nixon charged that you have been inconsistent in your position on the Vietnamese bombing halt. Would you please spell out that position for us, sir?
Well, first of all, I must say that Mr. Nixon seems to be rather of short memory. Immediately after the Democratic Convention, I called upon Mr. Nixon to join me in a statement saying that the two of us would consistently support our president in an effort to obtain success at the negotiating table in Paris, and that we would either say anything or do anything that would in any way jeopardize those negotiations. Regrettably, Mr. Nixon did not join. In fact, he rebuked me rather than to join in and try to make a common cause here. Secondly, my position on the matter of the Vietnam, on the bombing halt, has been simply this, that the first obligation of the President of the United States, whoever he may be, this president or the one that may come in January 20th, is to try to find peace in Vietnam. That I'm sure that the American people want an honorable peace and want it as soon as possible. I think also that any president, and I've said this, that any president would want to be sure that whatever action he took would protect the lives of our troops in the field in South Vietnam. And then I went on to say in my speech at Salt Lake City, which defined my position so that there could be no doubt about it, that I thought that stopping the bombing was an acceptable risk for peace if it would shorten the war and if it would lead to productive negotiations. I then went on to say that before making such a decision, I would look for evidence, either direct or indirect, by word or deed, that North Vietnam would restore what we call the demilitarized zone. I also said that if the North Vietnamese did not bargain in good faith, that I would feel free to resume the bombing. The emphasis of my statement was upon stopping the bombing, but taking into account before such a decision, two things: the safety of our troops, and secondly, taking into account evidence, either direct or indirect, by word or deed, of the willingness of the North Vietnamese to restore the demilitarized zone. Now, that's an international zone. It does not infringe upon North Vietnamese territory. It would be one of the easiest things for North Vietnam to do. I believe my position was outlined very clearly in a 30-minute television address, and I think that Mr. Nixon is the one who has, if anything, cast some doubt as to his position. He, on the one hand, says he supports the president, and on the other hand, he makes statements out about the country relating to Vietnam, which are not always in line with what is known as administration policy. So I think Mr. Nixon, again, has just failed to read the facts and study the record.
Mr. Humphrey, do you consider the use of the phrase law and order by Mr. Nixon and Mr. Wallace to be an appeal to white racism? And I'd like to find out from you what you mean by law and order.
Well, I'm sure that when Mr. Wallace uses that phrase, that's exactly what he's doing. He's identifying violence and lawlessness on a racial basis with the Negro. And I'm sure that when Mr. Nixon uses it, while he's not as open and as direct as Mr. Wallace, the implications are there. I have a feeling that that far too much of this talk about law and order has been identified with racial strife. Now, my position on law and order is, as I've stated before, that there's two, that we must have both civil order and civil justice, that without order, you cannot do very much to improve the lot of humanity, that without order, you cannot do very much to achieve justice. But I've also made it quite clear that merely to have repressive measures is not adequate, that there is a relationship between lawlessness on the one hand, disrespect for law, and poverty and despair and unemployment and hopelessness, that while it is surely true that it is that the poor do not necessarily commit any act of disobedience or civil disobedience, that the facts do reveal that in the areas of poverty there is more trouble and more crime than any other area, and that in that the poor commit more crimes and commit more crimes against each other. Now, I think that tells us that there is some relationship between despair and neglect on the one hand and crime and lawlessness on the other. So what I have recommended is a program to help our local law enforcement agencies to train our police better, to recruit a higher quality, to pay them better, and to have training not only in the methods of law enforcement but also in human relations and in the rights of a policeman as well as the rights of a citizen. In other words, to professionalize our police. You can't have what we call law enforcement or respect for law unless you're willing to pay for it. Now, on the justice side, it surely means that we must be willing to wage with equal fervor our energies against forms of injustice, of deprivation, such as bad housing, people that violate housing codes, building codes, landlords that violate those codes. You also have to have jobs and job opportunities. You have to have education and training. In other words, law and order to Mr. Humphrey means respect for the law, enforcement of the law, equal protection of the laws for rich and poor alike. After all, the black community needs law protection just like the white community. Black people, minority people, they need good police just like anybody else. And they need to be able to walk their streets in safety just like anybody else. But it also means that there must be equal opportunity under the law. And that's where Mr. Nixon and Mr. Wallace part company with me. They talk very loudly about law and order. Neither one of them have proposed a single thing to improve our law enforcement agencies, to upgrade the quality of our police, to really protect people from violence. All they've said is they want it. I say that you protect people from violence two ways, by properly professionalizing and training your police forces. And making them understand what their responsibilities are to themselves and to the citizenry. And secondly, that you give people the kind of an environment, provide people with the kind of an environment in which they will have respect for the law, observance of the law. And that means an environment in which people can live in decency, in which they can live in relative justice, in which they can have an opportunity, in which their children can go to school, in which their housing is fit for human habitation, decent housing, in which their recreation areas are adequate, and in which people can feel that they have a part of the community, that they're involved. Now, that's the way you get law and order.
Mr. Humphrey, we're going to ask some of the Night Call listeners to join us on our conversation tonight, and we'll take our first call from New Concord, Ohio. Mr. Kruger is hearing Night Call, OWMCO. Mr. Kruger?
Yes, Mr.
Good evening, sir.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. Your question, sir.
Yes, Mr. Humphrey?
Yes, sir.
I'm a senior at Muskingum College in New Concord, Ohio. Several weeks ago, your son Robert and his lovely wife spoke on our campus, and his talk was basically centered around your impressive legislative record previous to becoming the vice president. My question is this. Do you feel that the apparent gap in your legislative records between you and Mr. Nixon, that is, played an important part in Mr. Nixon's unwillingness to debate you on television?
I surely do.
I see.
Because I believe that Mr. Nixon has little or no record in his years in Congress from 1946 to 1953.
I would think that that would be an important part of a nationwide debate.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to debate Mr. Nixon was that we could place before the public not just our words.
In other words, you might think this is more important than the fact that Mr. Nixon was noted for having a rather disastrous bout with television with Mr. Kennedy in 1960.
I think so.
Yeah.
I felt that the American people ought to judge us, not so much by what we say, but by what we've done.
I see.
And to judge us on the basis of our respective records. We both came into public life at about the same time. We both served in Congress at the same time. We've both been vice presidents of the United States. And I thought that one of the ways that the people might be able to judge us best would be to take a look at that record, and also then to be able to take a look at us as we met the issues of today, because I don't think you can just rely on what we did yesterday. I think we must expect that people will judge us as to our vision of tomorrow and what we would do about the problems of today and tomorrow.
I see.
Mr. Kruger, thank you for calling, sir.
Nice meeting your son on campus.
Thank you for calling.
Good night,
man. This is Night Call in New York. The special edition tonight is the presidency of the United States, and our guest tonight is Mr. Hubert H. Humphrey. This time out to Albuquerque, New Mexico, Mr. Greenfest is hearing Night Call over KGGN. Mr. Greenfest?
Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
Mr. Vice President.
Yes, sir.
The one aspect of your candidacy I still can't swallow, and the reason why I still hesitate to vote for you, is the circumstances under which you were nominated. I refer to the brutality of the Chicago police in dealing with the demonstrators who came to your convention. Now, I still have to hear you refute Mayor Daley. I still haven't heard you repudiate the brutality. You gave your acceptance speech to the accompaniment of an orchestra while outside. Many Americans were being maced. I wonder if finally, now, before the election, you will say something to this aspect.
Well, my good friend, I was nominated by the Democratic Convention. I was not to be judged, it seems to me, by what took place on the streets by people who were not in that convention, any more than the mayor of New York is to be judged, may I say, in his election by what may have taken place someplace else. I don't condone brutality any place. I've never believed in it. I think it is unforgivable, brutality by police or by civilians. And there's any doubt that there were some police that lost their sense of discipline, that overreacted to the protests and to the provocation that took place out many miles away from the convention hall, I might add, in front of the hotel in New York, in Chicago. Those people were not in the convention. They were people that got involved in activities outside of the convention. I would have to be if I were to be accused of any responsibility for that, I suppose then the mayor of New York could be accused for responsibility of what's happening at Columbia University. It's really not his fault. He isn't involved in that, but his police are involved trying to subdue certain things that have happened up there. But we don't hear anybody condemning Mayor Lindsay. Now, he's in charge of the city. I wasn't in charge of Chicago. I had nothing to do with the police. I had no control over their activities. I not only deplored any violence that took place, I asked the Justice Department itself to check into it. There was nothing that I could do that evening that would do anything else but to say that it was a sad and unfortunate night and deplore anything that was a violence on both sides. And let me say quite candidly that since the time has taken place, that there isn't any doubt that what there were people there that deliberately provoked the police. They've openly admitted it. They've said that they wanted to provoke and they wanted to cause trouble, and some of them did it. Regrettably, a large number of young students that had no interest in violence where I got caught up in it. This is one of the things that happens many times when violence takes place. People that are very innocent are severely injured. Generally, the people that start the violence are the ones that escape any injury. Most of the time, whenever there's a mob scene, it's the people who were innocently caught up in it that are the victims of it.
Yes, but as the leader of the party, as the candidate, how do you bring the two worlds, the world of the convention inside and the world outside, together?
May I say that as a citizen and as a leader of a party, my interest was primarily in that convention, because that convention did some things that I think were very good. It reorganized the whole party structure. It abolished the unit rule, which I'd asked for. It modernized the selection of the delegates so that no longer could a governor or a national committeeman appoint delegates. There was free and open debate in the convention floor on platform. There were open hearings before the committees. This was one of the great historic conventions. It modernized, it helped modernize the political party. But in all candor to you, sir, what took place outside was something over which I had no more control than you did. I was in a hotel room, and I don't know where you were.
Mr. Greenfest, thank you for calling, sir.
Okay.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. We'll return to our guest, Mr. Humphrey, right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and Vice President Hubert H. Humphrey after station identification. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to Hubert H. Humphrey about why he should be the next president of the United States. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And tonight, the special edition of Night Call. We are conversing with the Vice President of the United States, Mr. Hubert H. Humphrey, and we'll continue taking calls. This time we'll go to, we'll stay right here in New York. Mr. Mandelbaum is hearing Night Call over WRVR. Mr. Mandelbaum?
Yes, Mr. Vice President?
Yes.
I was one of the many young people who worked in the campaign of Senator Eugene McCarthy.
Yes, sir.
After his defeat in Chicago, my family and my friends have not yet made up their minds whether to vote for you or to abstain. A great factor in the decision could be your acceptance of the principles of the Minority Peace Platform, which was defeated in Chicago and which called for an immediate halt in the bombing, mutual troop withdrawal, and negotiations with the NLF. What assurances can you give us that, if you are elected president, you will offer us a positive alternative to the present policies which we so violently oppose?
Well, first of all, may I say that there are very sensitive negotiations underway now, which I hope will lead to a halt in the bombing, and which we hope and pray can lead to a ceasefire and to the beginning of fruitful negotiations for an end of this war. Now, I'm not saying that to evade your question. The fact is that this is underway, as you know.
Yes, and I
feel that it is imperative that we say nothing that will jeopardize those possibilities. I've also stated that if the war is not over, or if negotiations have not proceeded to any success by January 20th, 1969, I stated in my speech at Salt Lake City what I would do. I pointed out that I thought that one of the acceptable risks for peace was to halt the bombing.
Yes.
That it could shorten the war, and thereby it could lead to success in the negotiations. I said that before taking that decision, I would take into account, and I want you to understand the words now, I said I would take into account evidence by word or deed, direct or indirect, of the North Vietnamese to respect the demilitarized zone. Now, I must say that that part is the easiest thing for North Vietnam to do, because the DMZ is an international zone and does not belong as a part of the territory of North Vietnam.
But
again, the emphasis was upon stopping the bombing. And I've also pointed out that the major priority, the first priority of the Humphrey Muskie administration, would be to find an end to this war and to do it as promptly as possible. I believe that that's as much as I should say on this subject. While there is still the chance that we might get a peace between now and the first of the year, I want to do everything I can to bring it about. Now, let me just say a word about this peace business.
Yes.
Peace is not just in Vietnam. There are other issues that are vital. The arms race, the nuclear spiraling arms race.
Right.
Which I think is a greater threat to your life and to the life of children yet unborn than anything that's happening in Southeast Asia. I've noticed that our adversaries, our opponents in this campaign, have had very little to say about that. Mr. Nixon did not support the nuclear test ban treaty. Neither he nor his colleagues ever lent any support to the disarmament agency of which I was the author. He made fun of and laughed at and ridiculed the Peace Corps, called it a haven for draft dodgers. His record in trying to promote any sensible arms control, I think, is very bad. In the meantime, all of my public life, I have led the fight in the Congress for arms control and for disarmament, feeling that this was one of the ways that we could contribute to a less dangerous world and one of the ways that we could contribute to peace. I want to do that as president, and as I've said, as president, I would initiate discussions with the Soviet Union on the missiles and anti-missile problem that we have, the spiraling arms race in that area.
Yes.
And that I would surely try to exercise all the influence that I could have on conventional weapons to reduce both their numbers and any increase in their supply. So on that issue, I think that that's a pretty clear differentiation between myself and Mr. Nixon. And on the other matters of troop withdrawal, I was the first to advocate that we should de-Americanize this war. And I pledged that as president that I would seek a systematic reduction of American combat forces in South Vietnam. And as far as foreign troops are concerned, it's my view they should all be withdrawn. And I believe in totally free elections, including all elements in South Vietnam. That includes the NLF and all others. Providing that these people will abide by the results of a free election, and that's what we should abide by. I don't think we should impose a government either from Washington or from Hanoi. But I do believe that free elections, properly supervised to make sure that they're honorable, would surely be desirable.
I see. Thank you.
Mr. Mandible, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York, and this time out to Boston, Massachusetts, Mr. Robinson is hearing Night Call over WBUR. Mr. Robinson?
Mr. Vice President?
Yes, sir.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Nightcall and WBUR for giving me this opportunity to speak to such a great person as yourself, a person eventually whose name probably will go down in history. But I've wondered, and I've often wondered, how a person who's seeking such a high office and a person who holds such a high office I was wondering how they feel about their own qualifications for the job. I mean, do you feel that you are the most qualified person running for the office, not necessarily running out of a total of three candidates, but the most qualified person running out of the total number of candidates who might be running?
Well, I suppose that's pretty hard for a man to give an objective judgment upon. Let me just put it this way. I've spent a lifetime preparing for what I'm now trying to do. First of all, I grew up in a family where my father was in the state legislature, was the mayor of his city, was an active worker in the Democratic Party, was a businessman, a fine citizen, highly regarded. I went to the university to study government and economics and history, graduated both in bachelor's degree and master's degree, and went on to do most of my coursework for a PhD. I've been a full professor of political science in one university and assistant in another. I was mayor of my city for two terms, one of the city of over 500,000 people, in which I had a rather good record, I think. If you'd examine it, I'd prefer you to make the judgment. I've served now for 16 years in the United States Senate. 4 years, I was the leader, majority whip of the Senate, working very closely with President Kennedy during those years as his one of his top aides and his legislative leader in the Senate. And now I've served for almost 4 years as vice president, where I've had an opportunity to prepare myself in terms of the knowledge of the executive branch of the government, how the budget process operates, the long-term planning that goes into our defense, all of the intricacies of our intelligence system, and the necessities of our country in terms of fiscal policy as well as defense and national security. I really believe that out of this background there, that I have matured and have the maturity and the experience that is required for high office. I'm not sure that any man can honestly say to himself that he has all the qualities that he would like, but he hopes that he can meet the demands that are placed upon him. I also must say that I selected as my vice presidential running mate a man of unusual quality and integrity that can help me share these burdens, Mr. Senator Edmund Muskie of Maine, a governor for two terms and a senator for two terms and a local legislator and attorney. Both of us are well-educated, Phi Beta Kappa, if that means anything. Both of us have had a wealth of experience. If you put it all together, the two of us have had about 40 years of public experience together. Now, I think that gives you some qualifications, and I prefer to be judged on the basis of my credentials rather than for me to pass judgment on myself.
I see. Well, thank you very much. I imagine then that you probably do give a great deal of consideration to your cabinet. Have you...
Yes, indeed.
Do you have any thoughts about your cabinet winning if you're elected?
Yes, sir. I can honestly tell you that we've given a great deal of thought not only to that, to the cabinet, but to other people that might serve in the government. I think that the first test that a man has to pass in my position is who does he have as his running mate. I think I selected a man of extremely capable man, a very capable man, man of maturity and judgment and prudence. And I think that it gives you some idea of the kind of people that I would want to surround me in the cabinet post. After all, no man alone is capable of running this government. He must have a good team around him. And I've been on the lookout, and we have what we call a talent search underway and have had for some time, just with the thought in mind that I would be elected. I wanted to be prepared to offer to the people the best that I could find, and I wouldn't do. I'm not worried about their party affiliation. I'm primarily concerned about their quality.
Mr. Robinson, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York, and tonight a special edition of Night Call is being presented as we are discussing the presidency of the United States, and our guest tonight, the Vice President of the United States, Mr. Hubert H. Humphrey. We'll return to Mr. Humphrey and more Night Calls right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and Vice President Hubert H. Humphrey after station identification.
The most obvious symbols of today's affluent society are the outdoor barbecue and the sports car. the most incongruous is the rat. According to the 1960 census, more than 4 million urban dwellings were completely dilapidated. 3 million more were badly deteriorated. And another 2 million had serious code violations or were overcrowded. If building codes were enforced, most ghetto buildings would be boarded up. During the 1930s, we saved the farms from starvation. Now the cities need help before they die of neglect. If you think there's nothing you can do to help, think harder.
Send for the free booklet, The Turning Point. Write Night Call, Pomona, New York. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect, from anywhere in North America to Hubert H. Humphrey about why he should be the next president of the United States. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And as we begin this half hour of conversation with Mr. Hubert H. Humphrey, who's calling in from Washington, D.C. tonight on the special Night Call edition, we'll go out to Austin, Texas. Mr. Schulman is hearing Night Call over KUT-FM. Mr. Schulman?
Mr. Vice President.
Hello, Mr. Schulman.
I would like to ask this. What major revisions, if any, do you propose in the draft system in the United States?
Oh, I believe that the draft law should be very much revised. I think the present one is an accumulation of a number of amendments and provisions and regulations that have imposed many inequities. I propose the lottery system, what we call the random selection system. I believe it's much fairer, and a young man age 19 will know whether or not he's eligible for the draft or not. If he is eligible, he'll know that he'll go. If he's not, he knows that he will not have to go, so that the uncertainties of it are taken out, and all of the special exemptions that are now included would be removed. There was just one thing that we would permit a 19-year-old whose number would be called under what we call the random selection or lottery system. If he was called, he could have the opportunity of having 2 years in college, but he'd have to go at the end of that time, or he could go immediately. But the point is that he would have to go. He couldn't stay in school and in order to avoid it. And he wouldn't he'd know that if he wasn't called, he'd never have to worry about being called unless there was a total war.
Has Mr. Nixon said anything?
Mr. Nixon has said something about this. I don't recall what he has said on selective service. He's indicated that he would hope that you could have that he was for a volunteer army. I hope that we can have that in due time myself. I think that it's fair to say that it would cost anywhere from $8 to $12 billion for one. Secondly, at this particular time, with the problems that we have in Europe and elsewhere, I doubt that a volunteer army sounds entirely practical. I believe that we have to at least temporarily maintain our program of selective service, and because we have to do that, we ought to make it as fair as possible so that young people will know exactly what their responsibilities are and not be kept dangling out on the end of a limb, wondering whether they're going to go or not going to go.
Mr. Schulman, thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York. Our guest tonight, Mr. Hubert H. Humphrey, calling in from Washington, D.C. on this special edition of Night Call. Tonight we are conversing with the Vice President on the presidency of the United States. And this time out to Lansing, Michigan, Mr. Cohand is hearing Night Call over WJLB in Detroit. Mr. Cohand?
Mr. Vice President, in Miami Beach at the Republican Convention, Mr. Nixon talked about an era of negotiations with the Russians.
Yes, sir.
Now he seems to be rattling sabers again and talking about building up a gigantic a nuclear arsenal. What is this going to mean in terms of our defense budget and our domestic programs?
Well, I've taken rather sharp exception to Mr. Nixon's statements, as you may know. The New York Times today estimated that Mr. Nixon's proposals would cost an additional $50 billion immediately. Well, now, on the one hand, he says he wants to bring the budget into balance, and he said he was going to do that by being able to cut some programs out. And now he talks about heavy additions to our nuclear arsenal, including nuclear navy and all, which would greatly add to the cost of the Defense Department, raising the cost, it was estimated, from $80 billion to $130
billion.
Yes. So I'm afraid that Mr. Nixon's going to find very difficult to cut $50 billion out of a budget. It's utterly impossible unless he wants to wreck the entire domestic structure of our country.
That's right, and this will cut into these domestic
budgets. Well, it not only cut into them, the truth is the budget has so much of it committed by law under contract, for example, veterans' compensation. There are many things that are the interest on the public debt, our Social Security payments. These things are committed by law. They're contracts. You cannot cut those things. There's approximately in our budget about one-fourth of it that is eligible to being cut. So Mr. Nixon's cuts couldn't possibly be to the $50 billion, and if they did, it would abolish every domestic program that we have that means anything like our education.
Right. Good luck, Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for calling, sir. This time to Amarillo, Texas. Mr. Jones is hearing Night Call over KPUR. Mr. Jones? Mr. Jones? All right. Mr. Jones has left us. We have a problem on that line. All right. We'll go out to Seattle, Washington. Mr. Burnham is hearing Night Call over KVOW.
Fine.
Mr. Burnham?
Evening.
Hello.
Vice President. Mr. Muskie is in Seattle tonight.
Yes, I know.
With the campaign. Sorry I couldn't get down to hear him. But I'm delighted to talk to you. One brief question. I've heard you talk on a couple of occasions and read in the paper in reference to the military prowess of the United States and how we are the strongest nation. And yet you talk of disarmament. Explain the two. They seem to be actually contradictory items to me.
What we're really talking about is the security of our country. We do have a preponderance today of military strength. What I am concerned about is that there are efforts being made and recommended by Mr. Nixon and others that we engage in a substantial increase in our military. Now, what you want is not just a larger number of bombs or bombers or military arsenal. What you want is an adequate amount to give you the security that your nation requires. Today, our security is, our preponderance of military strength is overwhelming. And I don't think that we ought to be talking about large expenditures to add to that unless it can be proven that it is vitally needed for our defense.
Well, can you have one without the other? Can you have a good military system, a defense system, and yet still have disarmament?
Well, the only way that you could have any kind of disarmament that would be effective would be a mutually agreed upon and an inspected one, for example. We now have a treaty that provides that we shall not orbit weapons of mass destruction in outer space. Now, we have ways to monitor that, to know whether or not someone is violating it. Secondly, we have a treaty that prohibits the testing of nuclear weapons on the ground or in the air. We're able to supervise that, to monitor that through electronic and magnetic devices and other seismic devices to make sure that there's no violation of it. Whatever kind of arms control you have, whatever kind of an agreement you have, must be mutually acceptable and must be subject to what we call a surveillance or investigation or inspection. Now, we know that we can do this because we've done this in certain areas. We have a treaty now, right, waiting to be ratified that would prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. This has been agreed upon by ourselves, and it's been signed, and the Soviet Union, and it's been signed by 80 nations. Regrettably, our Senate, because Mr. Nixon and his people resisted it, and it takes two-thirds vote in the Senate to ratify a treaty, regrettably, our Senate did not ratify that treaty. I think that could be very serious, because there are from 8 to 12 nations today ready to build nuclear weapons. Now, you already got 5 nations. That makes it, that's lifted the level of danger to a point that frightens most people. To add 8 or 12 more to it, then you never know what's going to happen in this unpredictable world of ours. So what I'm seeking to do is to, first of all, to slow down the arms race. We could spend hundreds of billions of dollars in an arms race and get no more security. Why do I say that? Because the other side spends it. And all you do is just lift the level of danger. We build, let's say, we build X number more missiles. They build X number more missiles. What you need to do is to try to make sure that your strength is adequate for your defense. Now, we have enough missiles today, and the Soviet Union has enough, so that in the first exchange of missile warfare, nuclear warfare, 250 million people would be killed. Now, that's a conservative estimate. It seems to me that that you really don't need to add much more to an arsenal that has that.
Mr. Burnham, thank you for calling. Thank you. This is Night Call in New York, and we have the Mr. Jones from Amarillo, Texas, hearing Night Call over KPUR. That line is clear now. Mr. Jones?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Humphrey. How are you?
Mr. Jones, I'm fine.
I have two questions I'd like to ask you, if you could just elaborate them very briefly. Number one, do you think the voting age should be lowered to 18?
I do, sir, and I've supported it a long time.
Is there any possibility of it happening?
They'll have to come through constitutional amendment, and when I'm president, I will propose such an amendment to the Congress, and I notice now that there's growing support for it. I think there's a real possibility of it.
Okay. Number two, there's a controversy about that the votes for you will be split between you and Wallace. How do you feel on this?
You mean the popular vote?
Well, no. Well, popular vote carrying the electoral vote.
Well, there are three of us in this race. The popular vote will obviously be split three ways. I hope that I'm able to obtain a plurality of it. As far as the Electoral College is concerned, it's my view that the electors ought to vote according to the plurality or the majority in their state. That is the tradition. It is not required by law, but it is required by tradition. In other words, you're in Texas, are you not?
Yes, sir.
Is that your state?
Yes, sir.
All right, let's say that Texas, and in a three-way race in Texas, that I receive a plurality. That is, I receive more than either of the other two. I then feel that the electors of that state should give me the electoral vote of the state of Texas. And there ought not to be any deals, any kind of arrangements. It's just, in a sense, winner take all.
Right. In other words, you believe that you should cut out the electoral vote and go by popularity vote only?
Well, we can't do that at this particular stage.
Yes,
as I said, the tradition in our country is that the man that wins in a state receives the total electoral vote from that state.
Yes, sir.
That is the law now. Now, if you were to change that to a popular election, you would have to have a constitutional amendment. In other words, without regard to electors, just adding up all the votes across the whole country, what the president received in a national vote. What we do now is we have electors from each state, and we add up those electoral votes from each state, and when the candidate gets 270 we're out of 538, he is then elected the president of the United States.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Jones, thank you for calling. This is Night Call in New York and out to Louisville, Kentucky next. Mr. Bogart is hearing Night Call over WLRS-FM. Mr. Bogart?
Mr. Humphrey.
Yes, sir.
I'm a sophomore at the University of Louisville here.
Splendid.
I was in charge of your campaign at the mock convention we had here. I sent you a wire about that.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
I'm concerned, having watched Chicago, and I know you can't be responsible for that, but I'm wondering, in your speech here when you were here not too long ago, you said that the third reality in the campaign is the necessity for unity and reconciliation in the country.
Yes, sir.
How can we maintain an effective minority dissent and still be a nation undivided?
Well, we surely would never want to repress dissent. There's a great deal of difference, my friend, between dissent and disorder. We have ways to dissent in this country. Freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of petition, freedom to ask for redress of your grievances, the right to elect, the right to defeat, the right to write letters to the editor, the right to get on the radio and the television. But dissent in a democracy that boils over into mob rule, to violence, or guerrilla activity, that's not dissent. That is straight disorder. And I think that we simply have to learn how to differentiate between the two, and this is one of the requirements, it seems to me, today of modern democracy. Now, as far as I'm personally concerned, I've practiced a lot of dissent in my life. I've led fights in the Congress for years that never succeeded until 10 years after we started them. It took us a long time. We were a minority. I've led dissents on a college campus when I was a young man. But there's a great deal of difference between open warfare and legitimate dissent. The right to debate, discuss, and dissent and dialogue are precious rights in a democracy. But the right to disorder, there is no such right. Mm-hmm. If disorder must be dealt with as a violation of law and as a violation of decent conduct, I don't think we ought to let them be confused.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Bogart, thank you for calling. This is Night Call in New York. We'll return to our guest, Mr. Hubert H. Humphrey, right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and Vice President Hubert H. Humphrey after station identification.
It means to wake in the morning and find that there's nothing to do. And what does it mean to be searching for something new? And what does it mean when you're...
What did you drop into when you dropped out of school? No job? No job skill? No money? If you're between 16 and 22, Job Corps can give you a chance. A chance to learn a skill, a chance to get a job, a chance to stop running, a chance to make some money, a chance to be somebody. Give yourself a chance. Call your local state employment office or write Job Corps, Washington, D.C., 20506.
Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to Hubert H. Humphrey about why he should be the next president of the United States. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
On our special edition tonight, our conversation is the presidency of the United States and our guest, the Vice President of the United States, Mr. Hubert H. Humphrey, who's calling in from Washington, D.C. This time out to New Orleans, Mr. Sullivan is hearing Night Call over WDSU. Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Vice President, I have a question, sir, that has rings of doubt in my mind. I haven't heard the issue discussed. It was discussed at length several months before, but it has since been quietened. And I wondered if you had an opinion, sir, on the investigation of Mr. Jim Garrison into the assassination of President Kennedy, sir.
Well, the only thing I can tell you is that I have felt that the Warren Commission report was the most reliable and substantive and accurate report on the circumstances surrounding that tragic event. I have no reason to believe otherwise. The men that served on that commission are honorable men. The report has been pretty much accepted by most people. I realize that the gentleman you referred to in New Orleans, Mr. Garrison, has had a different point of view, but I have not seen any concrete evidence that he has displayed that would cause me to doubt the Warren Commission. Now, I haven't followed it as meticulously as you might expect me to, frankly. I had come to the conclusion a long time ago that the Warren Commission was made up of the caliber of men, the men of such caliber and character, that there wasn't any sense in really trying to dispute their findings.
Yes, sir. Well, the question in my mind was that the grand jury in New Orleans here has indicted the gentleman and set the date for trial, so there must be a large amount of evidence that has not yet been presented to the American public, obviously, because it can't. And it seems to me that possibly, if this has occurred, and it has here, that there's something yet that everyone might not know about.
Well, I have no such reason to believe that, and I found out a long time ago that if you don't have reason to believe something, particularly if you're in public office, your discretion indicates that you shouldn't try to spread rumor or doubt. And until I have reason to believe otherwise, I will have to accept the results of the Warren Commission.
All right.
Mr. Sullivan, thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York and out to Toledo, Ohio. Mr. Swergis is hearing Night Call over WCWA. Mr. Swergis?
Mr. Vice President, I was wondering if a bombing pause in Vietnam was started, what would happen if the North Vietnamese would use this to their advantage in sending more troops down? Would you put a time limit or, you know, a number of days or a week, or how long would you enforce this bombing halt altogether?
My statement, I think, was pretty clear on that. I said that if the North Vietnamese did not negotiate in good faith, I would feel free to resume the bombing.
And also, would you escalate the war if it was necessary?
I think that rather than to answer an iffy question, we should wait to see what the facts would be. Point is, you have to protect your own troops.
Yes, sir.
And whatever it's required to do that, you would have to do. If the North Vietnamese were to take advantage of a halt along the lines that you've indicated that would jeopardize our troops, then as I said in my speech at Salt Lake City, which I tried to make a very carefully thought-out discussion of this subject, I would feel perfectly free to resume the bombing because I would consider they did not negotiate in good faith.
Well, that's fine, Mr. President. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for calling, sir. This time to Bethesda, Maryland. Mr. Mendelson is hearing Night Call over WAMU in Washington. Right, sir. Mr. Mendelson?
Good evening, Dell.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Humphrey.
Thank you.
Mr. Humphrey, Mr. Nixon, some time ago, made the statement that Washington, D.C. was one of the worst crime cities in the nation.
I heard that.
Did you
heard that, and of course he's wrong. If he wants to talk about crime on a city basis, there are many other cities that have a higher crime rate. He could have even gone over to the state of his vice president. And he would have found that it has one of the highest crime rates in the nation.
I see.
There are many cities that have a higher crime rate than Washington, D.C., and I think Mr. Nixon again engaged in demagoguery.
I see. Do you think that the reason that this sort of thing has occurred due to the fact that this city has some very poor areas?
I didn't hear you, sir.
Do you think that it's the reason that most of the so-called crime has occurred is because most of Washington is pretty bad with respect to the ghetto areas?
Well, there isn't any doubt that what conditions of injustice and poverty contribute to a high crime rate. It's not controlling, but it's contributory. However, I repeat again that when Mr. Nixon charges the District of Columbia, the city of Washington, with the highest crime rate in the nation, he is not stating the facts. And he knows so because the facts are very public notice.
I see.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
This is Night Call in New York, and this time out to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mr. Reddick is hearing Night Call over KGGM.
Fine.
Mr. Reddick?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Reddick. I was just in your city a night before last.
Yes, I know, sir. I didn't get to see you, but I'm sorry I missed you.
We had a wonderful visit. I'm very grateful.
My question is, according to the Washington Post of October 22nd, you refused to agree that if neither you nor Mr. Nixon got a majority of the electoral votes, that the winner of the most popular votes should be given the loser's support.
Yes, sir.
In the House.
That's right.
So that neither of you would have to deal with George Wallace. Now, I wonder why you wouldn't agree to that, because I believe you agreed that you shouldn't deal with George Wallace, and that would be a way of stopping that.
Well, let me tell you why I did that, because the Constitution and the public law provides that the House of Representatives, in case there is not a majority in the Electoral College for a candidate for president, that the House shall choose from the top three, and that the House delegation shall vote as a unit. That is, the state of New Mexico would have one vote, just exactly as the state of Minnesota would have one vote. And that would depend upon the majority of your delegation. If the vote was tied, it would mean it had no vote. Now, that's the way the law is, and I didn't feel that we ought to be making any kind of arrangements outside of the law. The law provides that the House of Representatives shall state by state, by a vote of the respective state delegations to the House, cast one vote for their choice for president. It doesn't say anything about who gets the most votes in the popular vote, or who gets the most votes in several states. It leaves it up to the House to make an independent judgment. And I felt that it was much better for me to abide by the law and to abide by the Constitution than to try to have some kind of a personal arrangement or some kind of personal view which did not relate to the law.
Well, sir, it seems that it would be unpleasant to agree between you and Mr. Nixon than to for one of you to have to work with Mr. Wallace.
I don't think either one of us will have to work with Mr. Wallace, and I intend to make no deals with anybody or make any deals around the law. I think that we have to look to the House of Representatives to fulfill their responsibilities under the Constitution, just exactly as the Supreme Court has to fulfill its responsibilities. Sometime that court has a 5-4 decision. It's a very close decision. And I think that sometimes the House will have to fulfill its responsibilities the same way. Now, this has happened twice before in history, in the year 1800 with Thomas Jefferson. It took some 30 ballots or more for the House to come to an agreement to elect Thomas Jefferson, President of the United States. And as I recall, the other man had a higher popular vote, but Thomas Jefferson became the president. The second time was with John Quincy Adams over Andrew Jackson, over Jackson in 1824. Now, I don't recall what the popular vote was, but the House of Representatives, under the Constitution, has the responsibility to sit as a special electoral college in its own right, with each state having one vote, and to select the man that they think is best qualified for president. Now, I personally believe that it would be good to have popular election of the president. I think the electoral college system is filled with all kinds of problems and may very well be obsolete. I would personally prefer to see the President of the United States elected on a nationwide basis by the popular vote without any regard to any other factor except the popular vote.
Mr. Reddick, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Humphrey, we have just about 45 seconds remaining.
Let's see if we can get one more question.
Well, some people have stated that you are very optimistic in terms of the future of our country. But looking at what's taking place in the country today, are there other people like you who should feel as optimistic? Do you see a way out? Do you feel that America can solve its problems and get together?
I surely do, and I think the history of this country proves it. We've gone through many a trial and many a difficult time, everything from secession to civil war to open rebellion to depression to political movements like the Know Nothing Party. Incredibly difficult times this country has faced, and we've come out of them each time stronger and better. What's most encouraging to me today is that millions of our people are coming out of poverty. This was never heard of before. No other country in the world has ever made such a frontal attack upon deprivation and injustice as ours.
Mr. Humphrey?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call.
I'm optimistic about the future.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, sir.
This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Vital Issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, another Night Call guest will be on hand with a subject of vital interest. Listen tomorrow night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church. Presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.